Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
You know, you have to represent the Fed as having been stolen economic and financial policy away from the public domain. It was part of the neoliberal project before neoliberalism really took form in Austria in the 1930s. You're picking up again, you're restoring the whole classical economic vision of productive versus unproductive credit, productive versus unproductive labor, and public money as opposed to private money. It's not that you're radical, that these people had a radical revolution to carve away the financial system from democracy, and you're restoring the classical vision of redemocratizing finance and banking.
You might recognize that voice, our guest this week on It's Our Money. It's renowned economist and polymath Michael Hudson. Michael was responding to our question about how viable is the notion and growing interest, need even, to nationalize the Fed. That is, to turn the Federal Reserve into a bank that serves the public interest rather than the interests of the powerful banking lobby that controls it and economies and governments the world over. It opens today's discussions with a hopeful encouragement for building the momentum that's needed to attempt monetary systemic change. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. Today we have the pleasure once again of Michael Hudson's circumspect wisdom about the history of monetary policy and its related context, as well as his insights into the economic policies that have resulted from them, policies like neoliberalism. Now, you may well have heard that term being bandied about a good deal more lately, and in case you want a refresher on what it means, here's a succinct definition. Neoliberalism is a modern political economic theory that favors free trade, privatization, minimal government intervention in business, and reduced public expenditure on social services. In other words, markets and profits are the highest goals of an economy, and public interest is best served when they succeed. This corporatist axiom is basically a carte blanche permission to do what you can get away with, people and planet be damned. It's a hot topic on the world economic and political stage now, because the policy has given rise to growing restlessness by people in the streets the world over, from France to Ecuador, who are realizing that neoliberalism has separated the people from the promises of a vibrant, sustainable communal economy. Noted linguist and political observer Noam Chomsky was quoted this week as saying, "The neoliberal order is visibly collapsing. It's giving rise to what Gramsci called morbid symptoms, among them being the spread of authoritarianism and the far right." More generally, Chomsky continued, that what we're witnessing is quite understandable anger, resentment, and contempt for the political institutions that have implemented the neoliberal assault. French economist Frédéric Bastiat described it this way: "When plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men in a society, over the course of time, they create for themselves a legal system that authorizes it and a moral code that glorifies it." So that's the setting of our economic and political reality, and the context of the many actions underway to make significant changes. Chomsky admitted as much, that the rising up against the neoliberal order has also given rise to activist movements that seek to overcome the ills of global society and to stem and reverse the race to destruction. It's on this last note of optimism that we see some of that reversing energy being deployed in Mexico, and not from a grassroots uprising, but from the presidential office of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Let's talk to Ellen about it, and we'll talk with Michael Hudson a bit later.
So, Ellen, your article this week is reporting some pretty exciting prospects for public banking and for governments stepping in to undo the damage that has been caused by neoliberal policies. The article is about what's going on in Mexico. Tell us what's up with that.
Yes. Well, Mexico has a new president who has been in office for a year now, AMLO, or Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO for short. That's the four letters. So he has a very left-wing government. For the first time in, I guess, 75 years, the government was controlled by the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, and or PRI, I guess they say. And that was quite neoliberal, conservative. So his platform was that the neoliberal era is over and it's time for the people to get back in. And he's got had massive public support. He's got the support of the people, but he's also got the support of business and of the military. So he could pretty much do what he wanted, like go straight for his policies, and that's what he's done. And one of them is to form what will be the largest bank in the country in 2 years as a public bank. So it's going to have 3,200 branches, which is close to double the size of the second largest bank. And the whole purpose is to serve the poor and the outlying areas where, outside the cities where they just don't have banks. And so what he has said is that there's no point complaining about this. He said, you all had your chance, basically, and you haven't done it. You haven't gone into those areas because this is a capitalist mandate, is to make as much money as you can, and those places aren't lucrative, so you haven't done it. So it's necessary for the government to step in. And he says it will be self-funding, basically, that he's already saved the money by cutting out fraud and waste and just sort of the luxuries of government. He's already saved a bunch of money, and so he's using some of that, and that there will be a small fee for the users, and that will be enough to pay the operating expenses as it goes along. So that's pretty exciting. And, the reason he got it in or was able to get away with that is that he's got so much support. I mean, like, we try to bring those ideas up, but they never seem to get very far because we just have so much opposition.
Another aspect of that, Ellen, might be that he has promised not to raise the taxes on the rich or corporations. And so apparently he's keeping his lines straight and his people happy. But I suppose, too, that, when situations improve, all boats get lifted. I suppose that at some point infrastructure in Mexico is, wildly behind as it is here, and that this would offer to improve everybody's lot simply by getting more money into play.
Yeah, it would get people's money out from under mattresses, it probably literally is under mattresses in Mexico, or it's not in banks. They just don't have bank services.
So we see once again how credit is the lifeblood of the economy. There comes a point where if you don't spread it around, things stop and people get upset. So his remarkable polling and support is probably a result of the same sort of frustration that people in the U.S. are having, not having their piece of pie.
Yeah. AMLO has gotten pushback from the central bank. They're worried about how he's going to pay for it and the capitalization requirement and so forth. And I guess they're worried that he's going to tread on their independence a bit, although he has said he's not going to interfere with the central bank. He's not going to interfere. He's not going to tax the rich, like you say. He's got the military on his side. But he did say that he would like the central bank to work with the government, to do more to foster growth. So the concern is that Mexico would wind up going the way of Argentina, which is now in like 50% inflation, because this is blamed on Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, the wife of Nestor Kirchner. So they were in power for 12 years. But actually, it was her successor who drove the country into hyperinflation, President Macri. So he went back to neoliberalism, and one thing he did was he agreed to pay off the vulture funds. And this is something that Nestor Kirchner had fought for years. And the way they did it was they took out huge foreign loans. So now they're stuck with this massive debt, and inflation has gone way up. The poverty rate has gone way up. So people are very unhappy, and they reelected Cristina, I think last August was the election. So she's now vice president, and one of her former ministers is president. So they're back in power, and now they're stuck with this even bigger debt that they have to deal with. But the point is, when Nestor Kirchner was in power, and his wife Cristina after him, the country actually did very well. I don't think that AMLO is thinking of going in that direction, because he said he wouldn't interfere with the central bank. But what I couldn't resist, you know, adding to my article, what he really should do is borrow from his own bank, just like the Chinese do, where they don't even have to go to the central bank. They own this massive percentage of the banks in the country, and all they do is borrow from their own banks, which then create the money on their books, and the loan is paid off with the proceeds of whatever they build. So he can generate his own money without going to the central bank now that he's going to own the biggest bank in the country. But I'm sure that'll be a while down the line if he does it at all. You know, I'm sure he'd get a lot of pushback from that. But I just had to plant that seed, because there is a way that these governments, if they had a strong public banking system, there's a way that they don't have to go through their central bank to actually create money.
Well, they will learn this someday, and they'll probably learn it from you, Ellen. So let's move on to our conversation with Michael Hudson. Thanks for that report. I think it's very exciting about Mexico, but so many exciting frontiers on the monetary horizon are happening. Thanks, Ellen.
Okay, thank you.
Now, let's talk with economist, archaeologist, and renowned political economist Michael Hudson, whose knowledge of monetary history goes back to about 5,000 years, but whose insights into our current reality are disturbingly candid. Among Michael's books, J is for Junk Economics, which describes how the commonly accepted canon of traditional economics is deceptively contrived and institutionally supported, even though demonstrably false, and Killing the Host, which lays out a description of the predatory nature of today's financialized economies, including the role that banks play in perpetuating a fraudulent, self-enriching system. In the face of commercial banking's diminishing reliability and trust, we asked Michael how he accounts for the rise of public banking's popularity.
There's a recognition that commercial banking has become dysfunctional, and that most loans by commercial banks are either against assets, in which case the bank lending simply inflates the price of real estate, stocks, and bonds, or for corporate takeover loans. And here in New York City, it's because of the redlining and visceral hatred. Certainly at Chase Manhattan Bank, from the very top to the bottom, they were very clear they were not going to redline. They were not going to lend to places like the Lower East Side with racial minorities. And they made it very clear to me that the reason was explicitly racial, and they didn't want to deal with poor people. At the same time, a lot of people in these neighborhoods used to have savings banks. There were 135 mutual savings banks in New York City, with names like the Bowery Savings Banks, the Dime Savings Banks, the Immigrant Savings Banks, to give you an idea of that they were specifically to serve the low-income neighborhoods. Well, the commercial banks convinced the savings banks to let themselves be raided, and all of the large sums, the capitalization of the mutual savings banks was just looted by Wall Street. And Sheila Bair at the FDIC told me she was quite aware of this, that the Wall Street commercial banks had promised, oh, we'll provide lending for low-income neighborhoods. But instead of providing lending, they simply extracted revenue from these neighborhoods. So large parts of the largest cities in America, from Chicago, New York, and others, were underbanked because of the transformation of commercial banks from providers of mortgages to emptiers out, just revenue collectors. And, of course, apart from the savings banks, you had the post office banks. And when I went to Wall Street in the 60s, 3% of U.S. savings were in the form of post office savings. The advantage, of course, is that post offices were in every neighborhood. So you actually had either a local community banking, like savings banking in effect, not like the community banks today that are commercial banks, or you had the post office, and this has been deprived. So you have both a deprivation of basic bank services, much of the economy, and a dysfunctional, increasingly dysfunctional commercial banking system. Well, it's still dysfunctional. And the question is, what's going to happen next time there's a bank crash? Well, you can look at what happened for what Sheila Bair, again, wrote about after the 2008 crash. She said the most corrupt bank was Citibank. She said not only corrupt, but incompetent. She had wanted to take it over. But Obama was, and his Secretary of the Treasury, Tim Geithner, basically were lobbyists for Citibank from the very beginning and didn't let it be taken over. But imagine what would have happened if Citibank would have been become a public bank, or if other banks that are about to have negative equity, if there's a downturn in the stock and bond and real estate market, imagine what will happen if public banking took over. They would provide kinds of credit that the commercial banking system has refused to provide, credit to blacks, Hispanics, and poor people that have just been redlined in what's becoming a polarized dual economy.
Right.
Well, the power in that realm, of course, is in the cartel, in the banking cartel. And they look at public banks as a threat. Of course, they hate competition of any sort, it seems.
Of course, it is a threat. It is.
And even when we say, Michael, that, you know, that we're not coming after the business you are already doing, because you aren't lending to small, medium enterprises and so forth, you know, we want to take on the infrastructure that you don't want to fund, they still are pushing back. How will we be able to get past that use?
I think you should say that, of course, you're not going to take business away from them, because you, as a community bank or a government-owned bank, would not make corporate takeover loans, would not make speculative derivative bets, would not do all the dysfunctional things that happened ever since 1999 and when the Clinton administration changed all of the rules. The problem is that the big commercial banks don't want the productive kind of loans that you make. For instance, the reason they didn't want credit to the Lower East Side and the Hudson Yards west side of New York was they wanted to sort of drive everybody out and then gentrify it, and then provide the money to the big developers who just basically bulldoze the neighborhoods, kick out all of the low-income people, and replace them with raise rents from $50 a month to $5,000 a month. That's what's happened on the Lower East Side since the time I first lived there and what the rents are today. So the fact is there's really a fight of the unproductive sector of the economy against people who want to use credit in a productive way that actually helps the economy. I think you can just paint it in very much like good versus evil, at least productive versus unproductive economics. Economics for the people or economics for the 1%?
I wonder, though, if the Fed is going to even allow the banks to collapse again with what they just did with the repo market. I mean, they can step in at any time to save anybody, and I don't know that Congress even has a say in it. What do you think?
I think that's right. I've talked to Paul Craig Roberts, we discuss, can they just keep on keeping these zombie banks alive? Can they keep the over-indebted zombie economy alive just by the Federal Reserve manipulating the forward stock and bond markets to support prices? They don't even have to buy stocks and bonds beyond the $4 trillion they've already put into quantitative easing. They can just make forward manipulations in the market that doesn't really cost any money until the big crash comes. So I think one should have a discussion of saying, just because President Trump says, look at the boom that I've created, look at the stock market going up, that means that the economy is getting richer and we're just fine with commercial banking the way it is. We don't need any public banking. You can show that this whole effort has become a zombie effort, and I think you have to expose the fact that what's happened is artificial state intervention, that what we have in the name of free market support of the banks is not a free market at all. It's a highly centralized market to support the predatory economy against the rest of the economy. So you have to go beyond just the public banking issue to say, what is the political wrapping of all this? What is the context? And ultimately, the way that you defend public banking is to show how the economy works and how public banking could play a very positive role in the economy as it should work.
Can you explain what you meant by forward lending? I mean, they don't have to...
It's not forward lending. It's buying long. You say, say for the stock market or the Dow Jones average, they'll say, okay, we will promise to buy all these given stocks in the average or the S&P 500, all these 500 stocks, we will buy in 1 month or 1 week or whatever the time frame is for X amount, 2% over what they're selling today. Well, once they have a guaranteed promise to buy, then the market is going to raise the bid prices and raise the prices for these stocks up to what the plunge protection team in the Fed and the Treasury have promised to buy them at. So by the time the price goes up, the Fed doesn't have to buy it because everybody's anticipated that, of course, the Fed would buy it at this 2% gain, and so there's a 2% gain. So you have to say that, look, we're dealing with a government run by the banks and the creditor powers to artificially raise the price, and what's this done? This has kept alive a system that represents itself as creating prosperity, but it's not creating prosperity for the 99%. And public banking would aim at the prosperity for the 99%, not for the 1%.
I'm just writing about Mexico's AMLO, who had just announced in January that he will be building 2,700 branches of a public bank in the next 2 years. He's expecting 13,000 branches ultimately, so it'll definitely be the largest bank in the country. And his reasoning is just what you're saying, that the banks have failed. They have not serviced the poor, and his mandate is to help the poor, and he can't do that if they don't have banking services.
Is that
in
national?
Mexico? Yeah, that's national. All across
right.
The country, yeah.
Lopredor, AMLO.
AMLO, yeah.
And so we know that a public monetary source is a public utility, and our vision, of course, is to create a distributed network of local and state public banks, which, of course, leads us to the view that really what we need to be targeting is the Federal Reserve, and that we want to ultimately turn that into a publicly owned entity. Is that folly, or
Well, I think the way to get people to support this is if they understand how the Federal Reserve is created. A few years ago, I published an article in an Indian economic journal. I think it's on my website, about how the Federal Reserve was created. And there was a whole fight by Wall Street and by J.P. Morgan to say, let's take America had a central bank until 1913, and that was the Treasury. The Treasury until 1913 was doing everything that the Federal Reserve was doing. And the idea of creating the Federal Reserve was to take power away from the Treasury. The Treasury wasn't even allowed to be on the board as an owner of Federal Reserve stock. The idea was to take decision-making away from Washington, away from democratic politics, and insulate the financial system from the democratic political system by turning control over to the corporate financial centers, Wall Street, Chicago, and the other Federal Reserve districts, which were exactly the same districts as those that the Treasury already had divided the country into. If you let people know that this was a fight that was waged in advance. Remember, these were in the decades leading up to World War I, when there was a whole social democratic revolution from Europe to the United States. And the whole idea was to democratize banking. And Wall Street very quickly developed a counter-strategy to this, and the counter-strategy was the Federal Reserve. You're welcome to republish my article on your site. And you say what you're doing is to reverse this counter-revolution that was mounted against classical economics, against social democracy, and by having the entity you're talking about, essentially that would probably be under the aegis of the Treasury, and you'd be putting back the economy in the direction that the whole world was going to before World War I derailed these efforts. You use the word nationalizing the Fed. I know people don't like the word nationalizing. How about saying deprivatizing or de-Thatcherizing the Fed? You know, you have to represent the Fed as having been stolen economic and financial policy away from the public domain. It was part of the neoliberal project before neoliberalism really took form in Austria in the 1930s, and you're picking up again you're restoring the whole classical economic vision of productive versus unproductive credit, productive versus unproductive labor, public money as opposed to private money. It's not that you're radical; that these people had a radical revolution to carve away the financial system from democracy, and you're restoring the classical vision of democracy. Redemocratizing finance and banking.
Boy, I want to thank you for saying that, Michael, because it deprivatizing the Federal Reserve is so much more accurate and powerful. You'll recall that we kind of exchanged a phrase when I said institutionalized deception. That the Fed is, I think that's really, really important. But let's say that prior to that, and let's say Stephanie Kelton gets in there, or somebody from the MMT crowd gets into a new administration prior to deprivatizing the Fed, does MMT have a place to play or to emerge in that environment?
Of course, and here's the role it has, that if you essentially you can leave the commercial banks to do what they're doing, but you're not going to provide Federal Reserve credit for banks to load the economy down with unproductive debt. Well, the question is, now you're going to create this community banking, public banking sector. Where is it going to get the money? Well, the idea is that it has to be. You want to begin providing money to the redlined areas of the country. You want to provide money to actually finance capital investment and people's living, not just predatory lending. So the The way that MMT comes in is it's very much like the Chicago plan of 100% reserves. Well, in essence, these community banks are going to only have the deposits they raise in their local areas. Where are they going to get the money? Well, MMT will provide deposits will provide credit to the banks in exchange for the banks. Loan originations that they do of a productive character on terms that borrowers can afford with realistic mortgages, also to build public housing. The Fed will be a major depositor and provisioner of what the new Fed that we're talking about will create, will provide the capital deposits and reserves to the banks. Right now, it's provided the $4 trillion of credit to the banks not to put a penny into the economy, just to manipulate the stock and bond market and to make housing prices more expensive for American families. Wouldn't it be much better to provide credit to the community banking that would actually be making credit for productive economic purposes? That was what everybody expected banking to be in the late 19th century, and Germany and Central Europe were leading the way in. It was even called Middle Europa banking as opposed to Anglo-American banking. And so essentially you'd be following the classical model as everybody had expected banking to evolve prior to World War I.
Cool. That's what I also wrote about in my latest book, that credit is, or what the Federal Reserve is there for, or where you should be getting credit. You don't have to borrow it from somewhere else. Like, everybody thinks this whole repo thing is so contrived. Like, there's,
right.
You know, it's rehypothecated on top of the collateral is used. One party owns it at night and the other party owns it during the day. In other words, it's all just fluff to make it look like they borrowed something that wasn't really there. So let's just acknowledge all money is just credit. And like you say, if you have a good loan, that, you know, a good project to be monetized, that's the whole point of the bank. It will turn your future productivity into something you can spend in the marketplace. And the central bank is there to provide the credit. Turn it into dollars. Yeah.
That's right. How to describe that? And my way of describing it is always to look at history to say, look, this is not a utopian idea. This is what made German and Central European banking so much more productive leading up to World War I. So we actually have historical examples of good banking versus bad banking, and the whole fight against good banking. In this case, the predators won.
Well, on this whole repo thing, you know, one big problem we have with our public banks is the 110% collateralization requirement in California. So how is a bank supposed to make loans if they have to take all their deposits and use them to buy securities, to, you know, something safe and low interest to back the deposits? But it seems to me that what the big banks do, and I think we could do it too, is so they take all those deposits and they buy federal securities at 1.5%, and then they turn around and use the securities as collateral in the repo market, and they pay 1.5%. In other words, they earn 1.5%, they pay 1.5%. So it's a wash. They get their money for free. And I think we could do that too. Or is there some... is it only certain players that are allowed to play that game and we can't jump in?
Of course. Well, you're the lawyer, so of course they could do it. Although I think one of the things that you and other progressives have recommended is that the Fed stop paying money to the banks. I mean, stop giving them the free giveaway. So if you want to say we're against the largest welfare recipients in the country, and they're not the people you think. They're the Wall Street banks. And look at these hypocrites. They want to cut back Social Security to balance the budget. They want to cut back medical care and social services, and make themselves the only welfare
recipients.
Recipient.
Welfare. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Agreed. But if, you know, if we just stand on our high horse and say, this has to change, we can't have them.
No, you're right.
Nothing will happen. But we could do it ourselves and just show what they're doing and point it out and say, this is what they're doing.
Then what you're asking for is symmetry. You said, you know, avoid the asymmetry. You know, they're making, we have to be allowed to do that. Otherwise, they're making us carry a big load on our back that they don't have to carry, that they're trying to load the dice in their favor. And you want to unload the dice or stop the insider favoritism. You represent, correctly, you represented the banks as being insiders. And you have to say, look, these insiders are trying to keep a monopoly. By the way, you could also use the anti-monopoly legislation that's been on the books since Teddy Roosevelt's time. You have a lot of legal power to break up the power of the banks. And you could treat the banks like I think they're going to treat the pharmaceutical companies if Bernie gets in and some of the other big monopolies.
The monopolies are being challenged by the shadow banking industry. New forms of payment exchange and technologies seem to be eating away at that singular source of credit. What's your prognosis for how that's going to evolve, and will the big banks find a way to clamp down on that ultimately?
Are we talking about cryptocurrency?
That would be one example, yeah.
You can't stop people from gambling. If people think that buying a cryptocurrency is like buying an Andy Warhol etching, you know, maybe it'll go up in price if a number of people want it, and basically it's junk, but it's very speculative, and it's certainly not stable. It goes up and down, one day there's going to be a solar flare that's going to wipe out all of the bank records for these things. There's no way you can stop people from doing something that seems to be silly or gambling, but you certainly will not insure them. You will not give them any protection against loss, you will want to insulate the economy from having any transactions in crypto, in these alternative money things that pose a big threat to loss, because it's not real money, because the government will not accept payment of cryptocurrencies as taxes or for public goods and services. And you have to, that's one simple way of saying the government will only accept, you know, such and such forms of money. I think you have to delimit and say people can, you can create any kind of monetary instrument or trade-off or bet. It's like if you want to create the equivalent of a racetrack on horses in the for financial instruments, you can do it, but that's the racetrack. I think there may be taxes on racetracks or something else, I know they're unregulated for a long time, but as the Hollywood movies all understand, they were all there's a lot of criminalization going on there.
I think we were all amused, but maybe in a little wonderment about Max. You know, Ellen and I had and Tyson Slocum had some time with him up there just before I think you did up at the Brooklyn studio. But Max is like into Bitcoin in a big way and sees that as, you know, as the new gold.
He tells me that a lot of people watch the show because they're gold bugs or they are interested in Bitcoin. I think he's tried to take a neutral view of it. Certainly in our personal conversations, he's not a gold bug and he's not a Bitcoin or other bug, but he said, look, a lot of people want to find out about it, and so he interviews he has his guests on the show to tell people, here it is, you know, take your choice. It's part of the new financial landscape, just like swamps are part of the financial landscape, since, you know, for Florida tours. So he's going to just cover the whole spectrum. It doesn't mean that he's really promoting them. He's giving them airtime because that's Reuters produces his shows, and that's the audience wants to hear about this. So he talks about what the audience wants to hear about.
I think he actually does promote Bitcoin. I mean, that's what he's heavily invested in, and he was one of the originals, so he's obviously made a lot of money on it. But I don't know that he says that, I think he agrees that it can't be a national currency. It's too slow, too expensive, and too environmentally unfriendly. But it is, like you say, it's a good investment, just like fine art or something, that if people want it, the value goes up. Plus, it's got a definite black market. But,
yep.
You know, there's a big black market for it, for trading and things you don't want the government to
know.
It's
a phenomenon. It's a real phenomenon. He may have made, I know people who benefited from Andy Warhol, junk art. I can. He saw the phenomenon and he might have made money. But when Steve Keen and I and others, we all got together with him for a couple of days 2 months ago, the topic never even came up once in discussion.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you know, when you take a look at money on the global basis now, and you look at the stories of Venezuela and Iran and all of that stuff, and Brexit, what's your take on what's at play there? It's the same old thing about domination and control for the USD and friends.
I wonder where the gold of Libya went, for instance. Apparently it was all taken, and I understand the U.S. gave it all to ISIS, that Hillary said, this has to go to ISIS, they're our foreign legion, and we gave them all the weapons. Some of the gold must have just been taken by the CIA and the State Department for dirty trick for its black operations. Certainly America wants to prevent any other country or any other large gold possessor from having enough gold to try to reinstate gold as a means of settling balance of payments deficits. Because once you did that, since America runs a large military balance of payments deficit, at a certain point, the more money it spends abroad for its 800 military bases, the more gold it would lose, just like in General de Gaulle's time, when actually Germany was taking more gold than France during the Vietnam War. So America wants to keep the dollar at the center of the world, and that was really why it went to war with Libya, because Libya wanted to get was one of the first countries to want to de-dollarize and move its currency towards gold. So you're having a group of countries: Russia, China, Iran, others, all adding gold to their reserves instead of dollars. You're having a whole de-dollarization move throughout the world now to get free of the U.S. ability to do what it did to Iran, and that is when Iran borrowed in dollars under the Shah, it had used Chase Manhattan Bank as its paying agent and put enough money to pay its foreign debts in Chase. And then the State Department told Chase, you've got to screw your depositor. You've got to just refuse to turn over the payment. And once you refuse to turn over the Shah isn't running Iran, but your friend frees their account. And that meant that Iran went into default on the entire dollarized foreign debt and had to pay a huge amount of capital when it had all the capital there. So that was a warning to the rest of the world that you cannot put, no government should put their money in an American bank or an American bank branch or in a British branch that acts as a subsidiary of the Pentagon, basically, because if you do, the bank can simply force you into default at any time, just like the U.S. CIA can come in and use electronic weaponry to destroy your bank payment system. That's why the threat of cutting Russia and China and other countries off from the SWIFT interbank clearing system led Russia to develop its own clearing system that with a flick of the switch can begin to work anytime the United States tries to cut Russia off from payments, from its payment system. So you're having the whole world de-dollarize very quickly. And right now the question is whether, you know, what will Europe choose? Germany and other countries, are they going to become part of the de-dollarized system or part of the dollarized system? It can't do both. This is part of the whole system of Huawei, the fight against using the IT chips and the communications chips from Huawei. Huawei did not put in a U.S. spyware into the system, and the United States says, look, if we can't have a phone system and a communication system that we can control by spyware and immediately blow up your economy, your public utilities, your electrical systems, then you're our enemy because we feel insecure. President Trump said they're a threat to our national security, he means that we don't feel secure unless we have the power to destroy any economy that acts in any way that is independently of the United States because you might do something we don't like. So this is the most aggressive concept of security that one could imagine philosophically. So of course the rest of the world is seeing its national security as having a financial dimension, and the financial dimension is to create a monetary and financial system that minimizes its connections to the dollar, except to the extent of having to buy and sell dollars to stabilize its foreign exchange rate.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of talk, even among central bankers, that we need to get off the dollar as a global reserve currency. But it seems to me that gold is also manipulatable. I mean, it's not the ideal. What would you see as I had envisioned a system where instead of the reserve, rather like Keynes was proposing, instead of the reserves being a thing like dollars or gold that you can actually trade, it would just be a measure, like a yardstick, and you would be able to compare one currency to another according to what you could buy with it. Like, you'd have a whole basket of things that everybody uses in every country, and now that they report that kind of stuff, it wouldn't be all that hard to get the figures and, you know, and just compare and say, well, your dollar will be worth so many pesos in Mexico or whatever. I don't. That was my idea, but what do you think?
That would meet one of the criteria of money, which is a measure of value, but it would not do at all for international money. You have to have some means of constraint. In other words, suppose the United States ran another military budget deficit like it did in the Vietnam War. The measure of value, there's no way that you could use the balance of payments as a constraint on the policy of deficit countries, which are usually the military aggressor countries. The whole idea of going off gold was that under the gold standard, no country can afford to go to war. Or make war, because if you go to war, your currency collapses. In 1976, Herman Kahn and I went to the Treasury, and this is to answer your question. He had a map of the world, and he put a map of the world, and he said, "Here is these are the countries, Scandinavia, Western Europe, the United States, that don't believe in gold. They're all social democratic countries. They all have faith in government. And look at these other, here's the rest of the world, and the whole rest of the world, South America, Africa, most of Asia. These are people that believe in India, that believe in gold. Why do they believe in gold and not the Protestant currency area? Well, they don't believe in government. They don't trust the government, and they want some option that is independent of government, and not only to bribe the border guards if they're escaping from somewhere, but they want free of governments that have been captured by anti-democratic, predatory forces. And he said if you tried to think of what you would make that is an alternative to the dollar that people could understand. Well, for thousands of years, people have decided that gold and silver, I'm sure you could add platinum and palladium, are the ultimate monetary constraint. Gold isn't to be used as money. It's not to be used as a means of payment. What it is to be used is a balance of payments constraint on the ability of countries to run into to run up foreign debt and to run balance of payments deficits that are mainly of a military character. So I called our presentation Gold, the Peaceful Metal. Well, needless to say, the Treasury didn't go for that because they said, well, wait a minute, you've just explained to us how superimperialism works, and it works via the dollar. Of course we're not going to go to gold. Nice thought. And that's how we left Washington.
Isn't the reason we went off the gold standard, though, that there simply isn't enough gold and that we wound up leveraging it and...
There's plenty of gold. There wasn't enough gold to pay for the military. Every month, the money that we spent in Vietnam, the dollars we spent in Vietnam, would be turned over to the banks in Indochina that were French. They'd turn the dollars over to Paris, and General de Gaulle would turn into Paris the dollars for gold. We had to pay for the military deficit, and the military was the entire source of the U.S. balance of payments deficit in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s in gold. And we went off gold so that we could afford to wage war without the constraint of losing our control over the international monetary system.
But we went off gold domestically because it didn't work. I mean, you had to use fractional reserve lending.
Yes, gold doesn't work domestically. It's certainly not an appropriate domestic money supply at all. I'm only talking about it for settlement among central banks internationally. Mm-hmm. Of course, gold is not appropriate
domestically. But you said it's not to be traded.
What?
You said it's not to be traded,
how do you clear your balance? It can be traded. I mean, in other words, there is a market. And you said that the point you begin at was saying quite correctly that gold price is manipulated. Well, right now, the U.S. and the central banks are manipulating the price of gold to keep it low in the same way that they're manipulating the stock and bond market by buying forward, except in the case of gold, they're selling forward. And if they keep agreeing to sell gold at a very low price instead of letting the price rise, then people will say, okay, if we can buy gold at this low price, why should we buy gold at a higher price today? And the price will fall and be driven down. So, yes, gold is manipulated downwards today by the U.S., essentially the plunge protection team acting internationally to keep the price of gold down to discourage other countries and populations from buying gold as protection against the collapse of the financial system. So we're back into the fact that the financial system is dysfunctional. In a functional financial system, you wouldn't need domestic reference to gold. You'd have a domestic financial system that works perfectly fine without gold. Gold is what you have when the financial system becomes dysfunctional and there's a breakdown.
Well, it almost seems like you need some sort of global regulator, but then that's like one world government, which we all freak out about.
You don't want a one-world government. You don't want a world government at all, because right now all the plans for world government are neoliberal. They are essentially to limit, to break up government. The idea is that a one-world government is to destroy any democratic government's ability to make its own laws in the interest of labor or society, and to create a parallel government of wealth, government of property. It's what the University of Chicago calls the law and economics regime. And this is fascism on a international scale. And there's a wonderful book by Slobodian that was published last year called Globalization, showing how all these plans were developed by fascists in the 1930s and by the fascist promoters. The fascist promoters were people like Hayek and von Mises and the whole Geneva school around of the League of Nations. So when they say they're anti-government, they're anti-democracy. They're for an iron fist of government. And the reason people don't trust an international government is it would be an international iron fist of fascism, the way it's, the current maneuvering of the financial classes and the rentier classes and the neocons have arranged things.
Well, I totally agree, and it's quite frightening, the idea of, I mean, we want sovereignty for all our little nations and even our little cities.
Sure.
And our states and so forth. But it seems to me, how do you get everybody to work together? For example, Venezuela has the problem that, or any country that's heavily in debt to foreign or to vulture funds or whatever, there's not a universally recognized court that you can go to and, you know, everybody agrees. I mean, it does seem like on some level we need some sort of collaborative effort where we all agree on the rules.
Absolutely right. Now, of course, the United States would not recognize any international court. So again, you'd have all the rest of the world belonging to the court, and the United States is the outlier saying, you know, you're not letting the parasite in. You know, it's like you're the healthy body, and we want to parasitize you, and the court it will not recognize the court. But what you there should be a court that would recognize such things as odious debt, that is odious debt for internet for governments. And Venezuela's problem is that it had pledged the security for its foreign debt under the dictators that the Americans had installed by assassination and force. Venezuela had pledged its oil reserves as backing for its international debt. That gives a vested interest in the creditors and in the creditor in the United States to make Venezuela default so that people can grab its oil reserves and its investments in the United States in the oil distributors that it's bought. So yes, you do need a set of international rules for deciding which debts. You need an alternative to the IMF. You need an anti-IMF that instead of acting on behalf of the creditors, imposing austerity on countries, you have a organization representing society. And what is the interest of society to grow? And instead of promoting austerity, which the IMF does, it would promote prosperity. Instead of financing the U.S. government dollarization and giving U.S. control, it would be part of the de-dollarization group. So you'd really have a growth part of the economy, of the world economy, that is using finance to finance growth and development and productive credit. And you'd have the United States providing predatory credit, austerity, cutting back Social Security, cutting back Medicare, and you'd have the polarizing economy in the U.S. As the economy shrinks and ends up looking like Greece or Argentina, and you'd have the rest of the world following productive financial policies. That should be ultimately our global dream, but there's been so little preparation for that, whereas the financial and neoliberals have tried to put together a whole almost conspiratorial type of law and economics group, so that it to try like the World Trade Organization, where no government can impose anti-pollution fines. If you fine an oil company for polluting, the government is obliged under this international law to pay the oil companies what they would have earned if they would have continued to poison the environment. This is
shocking.
Definitely. Yeah. This is an international death wish.
Agreed. Totally agreed.
We've been speaking with economist Michael Hudson. Our thanks to him for being on this program again, and you'll be hearing more from Michael on future editions of It's Our Money. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.